1 degrees now for both Racine and Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Today's morning show interview is from the Morning Show Archives. It was recorded and initially broadcast back in 2015. I feel profoundly privileged to be speaking for the next few minutes with Simon Goodman, the author of an extraordinarily moving and fascinating and also, in many respects, heartbreaking book called The Orpheus Clock, The Search for My Family's Art Treasures Stolen by the Nazis. In many respects, that title says it all. One can kind of imagine the world of pain and injustice which this story touches upon, and it is of course, a deeply personal story for Simon Goodman. He is not just writing about this search for justice and closure, but it is something that he himself has experienced, has lived through. And we are talking about a journey of decades as he has sought to understand what became of the priceless art collection, which had been part of his family. In the care of his own grandfather, who, along with his wife and others, countless others, were extinguished in the Holocaust, and that journey, that long journey, which in many respects is not over yet, is told beautifully in this book published by Scribner. And I'm very honored to be speaking with Simon Goodman about his book, The Orpheus Clock: The Search for My Family's Art Treasures Stolen by the Nazis. Simon Goodman, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
I appreciate this opportunity very much. Your book begins, I think, in quite intriguing fashion with you and your brother Nick.
Yes.
Opening a number of boxes. This is not long after your own father's death. Explain to our listeners what you found in these boxes and the intriguing mystery which they represented.
Yes, well, my brother and I grew up in London after the war, really in the dark. We had very little idea what our father did. He was a very uncommunicative man, and we had virtually no idea of our family history either. I mean, we just about had a vague knowledge that our grandparents had somehow died in the war, and they did have a few paintings. I had no idea really how many, and particularly what they were. So it's really not until my poor father dies and his girlfriend sends us all his saved correspondence and dog-eared art catalogs that we're actually able to piece together what he did for all those years after the war. He was always traveling, but eventually he took a job as a travel agent, but in a sense it was a cover. I mean, he was going from one government office and art museum to another, and he was relentless in his pursuit of what we now have discovered. It was an extremely large and significant, important art collection that belonged to his father, my grandfather, and some of it even to our great-grandfather before that. So these boxes were a revelation, and they changed my life. Amongst many, there were inventories, Nazi inventories in some cases, or of my grandparents' home, all sorts of letters to the big auction houses and government offices after the war. And also there were three wartime negatives, which we discovered were of three Impressionist paintings, and that's what really changed my life. Two of them were by the French painter Edgar Degas, and so I went looking for Degas, and my brother, the other third one, was of a Renoir landscape. My brother went looking for Renoir. I found one of our Degas in 96, I guess it was, in Chicago, here in the States. So, and that started what apparently had been the first Nazi looting case, legal court case, since the war. So I didn't know if it were possible, but we did get some kind of settlement. It wasn't ideal. I've since learned how to, you know, avoid lawyers where possible and approach museums and collectors direct. But there we have it. That finding that Degas landscape changed my life, and that was 20 years ago now, and I've been on the hunt ever since. With a certain amount of success, I'm pleased to say.
Before we trace back the story of your family, I mean, your great-grandfather and your grandfather and so on, I think it's important for us to talk a little more about your own father's intense silence on so many matters. You tell us again in the opening chapter that while other families still talked about the war constantly, that topic was strangely off-limits, almost taboo in your family, and moreover, any discussion about your extended family and preceding generations was, if anything, even more off-limits. Talk more about living with that veil of silence and the sense of otherness, which you tell us was one of the consequences for you and your brother, I presume.
Well, that's right. It was, in retrospect, I realized it was quite an unsettling upbringing because I had very little family that I was aware of. So in a sense, it was quite a lonely way of life. I mean, except I had many friends from school and things. So that compensated. Yes, everybody else after the war in London was still talking about the war, and we were justly very proud of the fact we'd won. It had been a long, bitter battle, but my father, apart from some of the obvious great victories, wouldn't discuss it at all. And his family, as we turned out, well, I mean, we had no idea of who his family were. And, I mean, it's odd. It turned out they were even cousins in London. But the survivors from the war, from the Holocaust, sadly all fell out, it seems, and didn't talk to each other for years. There'd been a bitter dispute over what little of the family estate was left, and it was my father's unfortunate task to try and settle the family estate, and nobody else was very happy. Obviously, there was much less than anybody expected, and so there were these bitter feuds, which years later, I was actually able to settle, finally, which is what one of the wonderful aspects of me finding the Orpheus clock, because enables me to contact all these far-flung cousins, or the sons of my children of my father's cousins and relatives, and effectively reunite the family. We get to fashion a new family contract, and we're all friends now. So it's a remarkable change, which is why I call the book The Orpheus Clock, because that's where I end the story on a positive note. But my father was a very sad, damaged man. And like so many who came through the war and the Holocaust, his generation weren't able to talk about it. It in a sense, it had to wait for the generation after, my generation, to break through the silence.
You tell us that there would be these tiny little glimpses that you would be given into your background, and but those glimpses initially made very little impression on you. I want to just read a portion of this chapter. You said, "At this time, my scant knowledge of this history did not much affect me. Any real sense of loss would only come later." In terms of talking about what your family had lost. But by the third or fourth generation, these stories usually become nothing more than interesting and perhaps only half-believed bits of family lore and legend. Young men think of their own futures, not someone else's past. And you go on to say, by that time, you were living in Los Angeles. Yeah. And in all the world, there probably is no place less conducive to pondering the past than L.A. I think that's a really interesting aspect of all of this experience for you, is the fact that you found yourself, because of this treasure trove of documents that you and your brother found yourselves pouring through, you found yourselves sort of thrust into your family's history and compelled to investigate it in a way that's... in terms of going after it with such relentless dedication is I should think, quite uncommon, and something that I'm sure came as quite unexpected to you.
I had no idea my life would change so dramatically. But when I was able to examine the contents of those boxes quite thoroughly, it became evident what my father had been trying to do, and it was a great eye-opener. Also, it was very comforting in a way to understand the reasoning behind his silence. It was something that had always bothered me growing up, and suddenly I knew why he was so troubled and had such a problem communicating. Also, I understood why he didn't want me or my brother to carry on along this path, because after a few sort of successes immediately after the war, he really encountered nothing but rejection and frustration as one door after another was slammed in his face. So, you know, he continued to try through the 60s, through the 70s, even the 80s, without any success. So I finally understood why he was such a disappointed man. So there was a huge outpouring of emotion, I suppose, on my behalf, that at last it made sense. And from that point on, I felt compelled to try and fix whatever I could in his memory, I suppose. Also, I was by that point angry when I realized that the scale of what had been taken from us and the lies and deceit that had gone on not only during the Holocaust era, but to perhaps your listeners' surprise, also after the war. My family in particular had to deal with the Dutch and the French government and also the West German government, and it seemed to me that they went out of their way to stonewall us. And no doubt other families in a similar situation. So I was angry, and it occurred to me and my brother that maybe we could do a little something about it.
Sure, and I suspect that this also gave you a sense of emotional connectedness with your father that you probably really never had while he was alive. But even from the grave, you felt as though you were continuing the quest which he had engaged in for decades to try to secure some kind of justice for your family.
Yes. So every little success I've encountered since has been very satisfying, because it's not just for me but it's for my father, it's for his father, and our greater family. And it gives me an opportunity to reestablish our legacy. We were a very famous, well-known family in Germany before the war, and I now realize their history was almost obliterated. They'd kind of disappeared from the history books. So this was my opportunity of putting our history back in place, and my chance to discover my roots and where we'd come from and why all this had happened. So it's been a very therapeutic process. It all makes sense to me now.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Simon Goodman, the author of an extraordinary book called The Orpheus Clock, The Search for My Family's Art Treasures Stolen by the Nazis. Simon Goodman, in this book, looks back at his own family's history, their roots back in Germany, an extraordinarily wealthy family, which had one of the most amazing, spectacular art collections in all the world, an art collection which ultimately was ruthlessly plundered by the Nazis. And the book, in part, is Simon Goodman's the story of Simon Goodman's tireless pursuit of those art treasures to bring them back to the family where they indisputably belong. Simon Goodman, before we talk a little bit about your family, I wonder if you would just say a word about what kind of work it was to uncover all that you did in terms of an amazing array of details about your family back in Germany, extending back generations. I just cannot begin to fathom how you were able to uncover so much of their story. And I don't mean just the story of the horror that engulfed them in during the Holocaust, but generations before that. To what lengths did you have to go in order to be able to tell this story with the kind of thrilling detail that you do?
I suppose I've gone to extraordinary lengths. I was determined to uncover the truth. Much of what I've found comes from national archives, the U.S. National Archives, to do with World War II, British, French archives, German archives. It's interesting, though, you see all of these archives sealed anything to do with the Nazi era until, they were all considered state secrets until 1995. So my story, in a sense, is a modern story because a lot of this information was under wraps for half a century. On top of which, going back before the war, again, it's a modern story. The internet came about. I was stunned to, when I searched for my great-grandfather in Google Books, for instance, something like 12,000 entries come up today.
Wow.
a lot of it is misinformation and mistakes, but there is still a lot there. And So in this age of information, I've been very fortunate. I also right next, quite near where I live here in Los Angeles, the Getty Research Institute has a vast store today of original correspondence of old European art galleries, a huge store of original photos, every art magazine going back to the 19th century. Also back to Google, I can find one book published in 1910 that mentions my family, and there's one copy left. It's being sold by some little antique book dealer in the middle of Belgium. I'll buy it for 30 euros. So I've amassed a very large library in the process of what I do. I'll collect every bit of information I can. I bought every memoir I could find written by survivors of Theresienstadt, the concentration camp, for instance, which is how I was able to piece together the year my grandparents were in that camp. Today, also, there's actually a historical society in Germany named after my family. So now the sort of veil of secrecy is being lifted somewhat, because they were a very important, powerful family. I mean, the bank, the Dresdner Bank my family founded, was the first to offer checking accounts and saving accounts to the general public. And so they were, and branch offices right across the new German Empire. So it was a huge success. They made quite a fortune, a lot of which was reinvested in the expanding the new German industrial economy. So in a way, the family were instrumental in helping create modern Germany. Unfortunately,
yeah.
They also financed the armaments industry, much to my chagrin. But
you call it one of the ultimate ironies of your family's history.
Yes.
I appreciated the fact that you not only outlined for us your great-grandfather Eugen Gutmann's extraordinary success in the field of banking with this groundbreaking bank which he helped to create, but you also give us a personal portrait of him that I found to be, I was surprised by the rich detail which you are able to supply in terms of telling us what kind of husband he was, what kind of father he was. How were you able to fashion that part of the portrait of your great-grandfather?
It was difficult. From in my father's boxes was a very small little memory memoir that my father had written just before he died. As it turned out, the Dresdner Bank, the new Dresdner Bank in Germany, now headquartered in Frankfurt, had actually asked him for his reminiscences of his grandfather. So that gave me a bit of detail. There were in his boxes actually a couple of letters from my great-grandfather to my grandfather, one when he was promoted to director of the London branch, and another one about how much money he would need before he'd have to marry so he could live in the style the family were accustomed to. So there were a few little snippets around which I was able to build the portrait. Also, following the art collection he amassed helped me gain an insight into his character. And then I found it in other memoirs of famous bankers and German politicians. They'd mention what it was like when they met him. So from different sources, I was able to piece together a good image of this obvious man who died in 1925 that I never knew. Today I have a portrait actually that is hanging over my desk right now as we speak, which I found by chance at an auction in Cologne, and I feel he brings me good luck. So he looks over my work, and sometimes I feel inspired by his aura, so to speak.
I should think. You finish this portion of the book with these words: "So this was my great-grandfather, a pillar of finance and industry, a social lion, a man of enormous wealth, a respected and widely renowned connoisseur of art, and a loving father of a large and happy brood of children. He would seem to be the quintessential man who has everything."
Yeah.
Let's talk about the genesis of the so-called Gutmann Art Collection. I appreciated the way in which you not only detail the kinds of pieces he secured and the caution with which he put this art collection together, but also what such a collection of art typically meant, particularly in that era. Why was it that someone in your great-grandfather's station of life would take such pains to assemble such an extraordinary art collection? What do you think it represented for him?
Well, apart from the fact he clearly loved these pieces and enjoyed the hunt for a particularly fine Majolica dish or early Renaissance silver cup, whatever it was he was focusing his collection on at that time. Also, it was there was a social connection, a social facet to having such a collection in those days. The Guzman silver collection was actually likened by a famous Berlin art historian of the 19th century to the collection of a prince, so which actually made a lot of people jealous, even the Kaiser, apparently. So the point was, it was a symbol of, I think, Jewish emancipation. It said very loudly and clearly, we have arrived and we are anybody's equal. And also he was taking a leaf out of the Rothschild collection in Frankfurt, which some of the pieces in our collection actually came from. Also, I think he was inspired as a boy by the collection of the Kings of Saxony. In the corner of the palace in Dresden, the capital, is a marvelous place which is now open, has been open to the public for quite a while, actually, called the Green Vault or Grünes Gewölbe, which has probably the best assembly of the kind of artworks and objets d'art that my great-grandfather collected, things like gilded Nautilus cups and silver-framed ivory goblets and all that. So, I mean, that I think inspired him as a boy. He was shown around by, the son of the court Jew who was called Kaskel, who was a family friend.
Mm. You tell us that your great-grandfather Eugen seemed to have a special appreciation and fascination with pieces that combined beauty and function. And certainly that would be one of the reasons why he found himself drawn to that priceless work of art, which also gives your book its title, the Orpheus Clock, which he laid eyes on in Paris. Tell our listeners more about the Orpheus Clock, who had first created it, and why this represented something of extraordinary beauty and rarity.
There are apparently about 10 or 11 so-called Orpheus clocks still in existence to this day, but they're all actually made by different goldsmiths. But the goldsmiths were centered in Bavaria, either in Nuremberg or Augsburg, which Nuremberg was the capital of the German or the Holy Roman Empire at the time, which is why all the great jewelers, goldsmiths, silversmiths, worked in that area. Our particular one, I'm proud to say, was considered possibly the greatest. The dial was fashioned by Wenzel Jamnitzer, who was probably the preeminent goldsmith of his time, and it's a very incredibly elaborate, beautiful, enigmatic. I mean, it took me a while to see even where the hand was. There's only one hand, by the way. It's an absolutely fascinating, beautiful piece, and yet it combines great mechanical skill that is obviously hidden from the viewer that's inside the case. So it's a remarkable combination of great artistic achievement and advanced scientific achievement for the day. There were many such thick pieces in his collection. He had quite a series of automatons. My surviving aunt, who's now 97 and lives in Italy's favorite, it was brought out to her on special occasions, was an ostrich that would flap its wings every hour, and there was a little gold monkey in front of it that would beat its drum. There was another silver Dutch lady that would strum a lute. These were extraordinary mechanical toys, I suppose, but fashioned out of beautiful materials and exquisitely put together. So I'm not surprised he was fascinated by all this. I've become, if following in his footsteps, equally fascinated.
As you describe this specific clock, the Orpheus clock, you say, as if you visualize all of its exquisite features. You say one has an idea of the mechanical mastery and artistic genius of this clock. We're speaking with Simon Goodman about his book called The Orpheus Clock. I think it's so telling that towards the end of the chapter that you focus specifically on your great-grandfather Eugen Gutmann, that when you describe his children and something about their lives, and in particular his youngest child, his son Fritz, your grandfather, you end the chapter in this way by saying, unlike Eugen, who had lived in an era and in a country that, though flawed, had allowed him to flourish and prosper, Fritz was entering an era of upheaval and great uncertainty. I'm so glad that you make that observation, because I think for many of us who maybe look at history through too casual and careless an eye, that is the kind of thing that we tend to not think about. The fact that, in a sense, timing is everything, and that the circumstances in which one is living can make all the difference between a life of happiness and prosperity and a life that descends into unspeakable horrors. And that is the distinction between these two men.
Well, that's right. My poor grandfather had the misfortune of being in two world wars. So his father's life, in comparison, was one of peace and luxury. I mean, the Germans had a war with France, the Franco-Prussian War, but the Germans won, and there wasn't any conflict actually on German soil. So Germany was largely a peaceful country during my great-grandfather's life, and also it coincided with an enormous advancement in the social economic conditions of German Jews. So my grandfather, in a way, epitomizes that rise, and his father before him too, whereas my grandfather suddenly is thrust into the turmoil of the early 20th century. Even the First World War, I devote a fair amount of description to that. He spends the First World War in a British camp. Poor man.
Right. Isle of Man. It's his. You say Fritz's incarceration began in a rather civilized manner. Explain why he was incarcerated.
Well, because he was a German citizen. It was as simple as that. World War One broke out unexpectedly. I mean, people were expected that there would be maybe a war at some point, but nobody knew when. And then when Archduke Ferdinand was assassinated in Sarajevo, suddenly all hell let loose. My grandfather was the director of the London branch of the Dresdner Bank at the time. And so they lived in Surrey, just south of London. My father was actually born there, which is fortunate, so he qualified for a British passport. When First World War was declared, all able-bodied men of German and Austrian citizenship were rounded up. The women and children were let go, so my grandmother with her baby, my father, were allowed to get on a freight ship and sail to a neutral country, Holland or Sweden, you know. And my grandfather was taken up to the Isle of Man, you know, sort of lonely, windswept island in the Irish Sea. And he stayed there for about 3 years until a Swedish diplomat, a family relative actually, was able to have him exchanged. They did a sort of prisoner of war exchange, and he ended up in Holland himself, which is where he decided he actually liked the peace of Holland, which had been neutral in the First World War, and he decided to settle there. Also prophetically, because I think he wanted to distance himself from Germany.
Right. So he was interned in a place roughly comparable to the infamous Japanese internment camps here in America during the Second World War. This was a sort of comparable experience. I do want you to take a moment to explain one of the most extraordinary, though small, moments in this epic story, namely the astonishing surprise which you found in a small shop, which brought you a tangible connection to this chapter of your grandfather's life.
Oh yes, I was in Holland, I've been often, you know, and I go through all the museums, and I was actually in a sort of antique bookshop, quite by chance. I don't know if it's by chance or if there's something leading me to these things, because I've found many artifacts that had once belonged to my family. So I wonder how. Anyway, I have a sixth sense perhaps for this. I found the first print of a ex libris seal that another inmate, who was obviously an artisan, who had been incarcerated with my grandfather on the Isle of Man during the First World War. He's made this ex libris stamp for so that my grandfather could, you know, imprint all the books in his library with it. And this was the first sort of etching of what the stamp, the seal, would look like. And he'd signed it and dated it Douglas, which is the sort of capital of the Isle of Man, 1917. And so this little engraving was in a smallish frame, about sort of 8 by 8. And I saw it hanging on the wall behind this musty bookshelf. And I realized that it, you know, if I squinted, it had... it says Ex Libris F.B. Gutmann, which are those are the initials and family name of my grandfather. So, of course, I bought it right away. I tried to conceal my excitement because I didn't want to, you know, put myself in a position where they charged me twice as what they would get from anybody else. But so I kept my cool and bought it for quite a reasonable price and took off. And I mean, this was in, I was outside The Hague, so this actually wasn't far from my grandfather's last residence before he was arrested by the Nazis.
Amazing.
So, you know, I can only imagine it was probably one of those little things that was left behind by the Nazi looters, who they left the crumbs to the sort of the Dutch collaborators who stripped the house of the final bits and pieces that was even down to the pots and pans in the kitchen.
Wow.
So this is probably somebody had taken it out of the house in 1943, and it had ended up, you know, here we are in 2000s in this antique bookshop. Just, I mean, The Hague is only about 25 miles from my grandparents' old home.
Hmm. One of the things I appreciate about the portion of the book in which you describe your grandfather Fritz and his wife, their life in Holland between the wars, is that you help us understand how he and other members of your family and other members of this sort of sector of German society and those who were living in other places like Holland, how they could possibly miss the mounting horror with the rise of Nazism until, in so many cases, tragically, it was too late for them to save themselves from it. And I think, for many of us who look back on this portion of history, it's such a hard thing for us to understand.
Yeah.
And so especially, of course, a tragic story for your grandfather who made the choice not to leave Holland and flee for England,
yeah,
like others were.
Yeah.
Say a word about this portion of the story in which you try to kind of understand maybe the seeming unwillingness or inability of some people to understand what was happening.
Well, I suppose because nothing quite as awful as the Holocaust had ever taken place in history before. Germany had been quite a civilized country, and I think people of my grandparents' generation understood that Hitler was a crackpot, but they probably thought he could be controlled, or that he'd have his fling, you know, he'd have his day in power briefly, and it would be a catastrophe, and the Germans would kick him out. And then my grandparents particularly had already moved country. They'd settled in Holland. They were very happy and comfortable in Holland. I think my grandfather just, you know, didn't feel able to leave again. Also, he was presiding over not just his own, most of his art collection, but also the family silver and gold collection that he was the custodian of. I guess he felt he couldn't just run and abandon it. I mean, everybody was surprised by how quickly the Germans invaded when they did, and how quickly Holland, Denmark, you know, France, Belgium, they all fell within a matter of days. It took the British by surprise. It took everybody by surprise. My grandfather did actually, though, prophetically send my father in England a cable saying, don't come back. So he sort of knew enough of what was perhaps going to happen to tell his children, stay away. And also he figured his daughter, my aunt, was safe in Italy for the time being. And yet he couldn't leave himself.
Right. I think one of the most touching moments is in the book is this. At the end of this chapter called The Ephemeral Peace, you write, Bernard, that would be your father, one of their sons, sent telegrams imploring Fritz and Louise to leave Holland and join him in Britain while there was still time. Stubbornly, Fritz refused, though he certainly had the means to do so. It's one of those situations in which I want to shout back across the generations to ask my grandfather why he stayed. Why didn't he and my grandmother drop everything and flee? But there are no answers. In the section of the book called Devastation, you, of course, recount this nightmare as it envelops your grandparents. And in particular, the role that this priceless art collection played and the fact that it was plundered bit by bit, in which your grandfather was compelled to sign away portions of it to the Nazis. It's hard to even fathom what that would feel like for someone of your grandfather's station in life to be placed in such a humiliating situation, grasping after a hope that his cooperation would somehow lead to the survival of himself and his wife, hopes, of course, that ultimately were dashed.
Well, that's right. He still, I suppose, at least at the beginning of the invasion of Holland, he thought he could negotiate with these people. One of his neighbors, called Catalina von Panwitz, through actually my grandfather's sort of brokerage, if you like, was able to turn over most of her collection to Göring's agents, and she was allowed to leave the country. So in the early days, it was a sort of a period of flux. But gradually the noose tightened and they just peeled away at the collection bit by bit. The money, what money theoretically ever was paid, very below market value. I mean, although whatever market value would have been in the middle of a war, you know, whatever pittance was paid went into a frozen bank account, and usually those banks at the end of the year transferred all what they called euphemistically abandoned Jewish assets. They were sent back to Berlin, where they transferred into Nazi war bonds, which is usually the sort of shell game they played with their money. Bit by bit, everything was taken. I discovered a series of letters in the German National Archives in Koblenz on the Rhine River between two of Hitler's top Nazi agents, a man called Haberstock and another one called Berler, where they between themselves magnanimously agree that they will leave my grandparents a certain amount of their furniture in the house, at least as long as they quote-unquote stay in the house, which the implication was they realized that it wouldn't be long before they would no longer be there. But they thought they were being such gentlemen, saying, well, we'll leave them some chairs to sit on. But eventually even those were taken away.
And, of course, ultimately, your grandparents are taken into custody, ultimately taken to Theresienstadt,
yes.
And ultimately their lives are extinguished, along with the lives of so many others lost in the Holocaust. In the last couple of minutes, I want us to return to what is the heart and soul of your book from that point on. That is your tireless efforts to secure at least some of the incredible art treasures that had been part of your family once upon a time. As you have engaged in this struggle, which you recount in fascinating detail, I wonder if you can say a word about what this quest has meant to you emotionally, and what have these successes, some small, some significant, what have they meant to you on a very personal, sort of emotional level? What has this quest brought to you?
Well, mostly it's been a very gratifying experience because it proves that one man, I used to be in the music business. I had no idea of anything like this could ever be done, achieved. I'm surprised by what I have managed to do, along with my brother and others, and I'm very proud of the fact that, because everybody warned me at the beginning, you can't change the past. Well, I beg to differ. I have somehow been able to reach back and tweak the past in some way, and if it's possible to right even the tiniest little wrong that took place back then, I feel very, very good about it. Also, I'm proud of the fact I was able to tell this story, and now the book is out there. I hope a lot of people read it. I think it's an important story, and there are aspects of it, certainly, that have never been told in such detail or from such a personal point of view, a family's point of view before.
Exactly.
All of this is a big step in the right direction. I think along the way, I've seen a lot of changes, for instance, in the art world. When I started on this quest, the big auction houses were vehemently opposed to what my brother and I were doing. Today, however, they both have, the two big auction houses, have restitution departments, well-stocked and staffed and headed by quite powerful vice presidents who actually I can count as my friends today. If something comes up at Sotheby's, for instance, with my family's name in the provenance, they actually call me. So this is a huge step in the right direction, that it is possible for one little guy to make a difference, is the bottom line.
And I appreciate how you describe this as an injustice that was brought about in part by unscrupulous art dealers and willfully negligent auction houses, as well as museum directors and wealthy collectors, all party to this theft long after the war was over. A complicated landscape into which you strode very bravely and have made a very big difference for the better. The book again is called The Orpheus Clock, The Search for My Family's Art Treasures Stolen by the Nazis, published by Scribner, with many photographs, including beautiful full-color plates that show us some of the treasures that are part of this Goodman family collection at the heart of this extraordinary story. Simon Goodman, thank you so much for writing such a brilliant and fascinating book and for joining me today on the morning show to talk about it. It's been a privilege.
And it's been a pleasure to be with you this morning.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, we preview for you the main stage musical at Carthage College, which opens this weekend. It is the musical version of the familiar and popular film Legally Blonde. And on Friday's morning show, we'll be previewing for you a theatrical production about to open at the University of Wisconsin Parkside, as well as previewing the opera workshop